This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The number of lives the pandemic has claimed in Indiana continues to rise, but the pandemic has also had an impact on the conditions in which families say goodbye to their loved ones. Even when COVID-19 was not a factor in death, guidelines around social gatherings and public health concerns are changing the way that funerals and memorials are being held. Joining us now to talk about how funeral services have changed in response to the pandemic is Jennifer Nelson-Williams, the president of ARN Funeral and Cremation Services in Zionsville, Indiana. Jennifer, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's my honor.
So we know that death is not something that we can put a pause button on, even when it feels like everything else has been otherwise incredibly altered. When did it become clear that COVID-19 was going to have an impact on the way that funerals, cremations, and goodbyes were going to be planned?
We've really seen a change in the last 2 weeks. This week, certainly, last week, and then a little bit the week before. I don't know that people necessarily understood the impact. And what I mean in terms of change is with the guidelines of no more than 10 people gathering for an occasion, it's really impacted how mourners say goodbye to their loved ones. And I think initially it was thought to be something soft that we would try and abide by. And now in the last 2 weeks, certainly, it's become something that we're really standing firm on. So it really has made a difference.
Have you been given any guidelines about how funeral services are to be held?
Just the maximum of 10. But what that means is that for a graveside service, only 10 people can be there. And so that includes the cemetery workers, the clergy, my own staff, which leaves 2 to 3, maybe 4 people that the family can have in a gathering for their committal service. For funerals at the funeral home, they've pretty much become non-existent. We did have one visitation here where people were able to walk under our portico, only people who lived in the same house together, and we placed their loved one in proximity to the door so that they could say goodbye. The hardship is that many of these people, even those that have died not being COVID positive, are dying alone without the presence of their family because nursing centers have closed their doors to visitors. So the impact and the repercussions are, the ripple effect is quite large.
What's it like, I guess, looking upon those smaller services? What does it feel like?
Well, I think the meaning is still there. I think the feelings are still there, but it is heartbreaking to know that children aren't able to be there to mourn their parent, or grandchildren aren't able to be there. We are streaming the services and putting them onto our website, and so family and friends are able to log on and watch the service. But you don't get the support system that one would normally get when friends and colleagues and extended family are able to be present.
Many families have lost a loved one during this pandemic, but the death may have been entirely unrelated to COVID-19. How have families received these new social restrictions?
At first, we had a burial during the very first week, so it's almost been a month now, and I mentioned about the 10-person limit, and somebody said, well, you know, that's just a recommendation. But when I, you know, and I had to point out that not only are they putting themselves at risk, but the cemetery workers could potentially be at risk, and that my staff has, you know, young children, and they're trying to protect them. But I think now, in the last few days, people have a much better understanding and a much better respect for why the restrictions have been put in place. As a matter of fact, one of the families that we memorialized this week, it was for a very prominent person in the community who had died from, who was COVID positive, and his wife had also been COVID positive. And I offered them the ability to come back later on in the summer and have a service here in our chapel, in our facility that's lovely. And she was very pleased with that because although she wanted to make sure everybody was safe on the day of the funeral, she does want to be able to have something that she feels is more appropriate for her husband. So I think we're just going to find everyone has to sacrifice a little bit and be a little, you know, much more accommodating to the situation and work together so that everyone can feel they had the services that they wanted to have.
Has the involvement of clergy changed at all during some of these services? Perhaps not all. What has that been like?
Well, some of the clergy in the community are older themselves, and they are concerned about their families and their own health. I think they're exploring ways that they can serve their families but also remain safe. At the moment, I haven't been made aware of any major changes, but I think that there have been some backroom gathering of clergies to discuss the possibilities of what else could be done.
Planning a funeral can be emotionally straining, even under normal circumstances. So what kinds of adjustments have been made to help families navigate that same process from a distance?
We have been meeting with families virtually, by email, by phone, having them come and sign papers, but the papers have just been laid out on a banquet table so that we're not coming in close proximity with them. And, you know, people are fairly understanding to that. It's more us trying to protect them as we've served now many COVID-positive individuals who have died. We want to make sure that we're keeping the community safe. So it's not a lack of wanting them to come in. It's more for their protection, that we just want to make sure we're not carriers. I think everybody's been understanding. Luckily, we had begun this process over the course of the last couple of years because there's families that we serve where their loved ones have been out of town. So we've been ramping up this service, but certainly we're perfecting it at this moment. And everyone has to be understanding and willing to bend a little bit. It's not easy. And I fear that people feel they're not getting the customer service or the handholding that they may need or want. But again, it's all for the protection of the community at large.
So you've seen a few COVID-19 related deaths, but has the rate of deaths remained stable otherwise?
Now, I really feel that the mortality rate has increased dramatically.
Even not related to COVID-19?
Yes. Mm. Over what we would typically see in the Midwest in the spring month. The weather has been fairly nice here, fairly accommodating. So typically you would see the death rate go down in April, May, and for the summer months. But I think the loneliness, the fact that family cannot go in and visit their loved ones, has created a time when people just are not finding the will to carry on.
Can you explain what the typical protocol for handling and preparing bodies is, and has that changed at all in the light of the pandemic?
So as funeral professionals and medical care professionals, one is trained to always exercise universal precautions. So due to HIPAA, which are the privacy laws, healthcare professionals may not be in funeral professionals may not be notified that someone has a communicable disease or a certain type of condition. So we always have to be on alert to protect ourselves and to protect the people that may come in to see their loved one. So we are always wearing gloves and gowns, and masks are available, eyewear. But when you're just thinking that it's a possibility and now knowing it is an actuality, I think it does cause a level of stress that is unprecedented. We are trying to be safe, and we are cleaning more diligently and certainly making sure our masks are fully on our faces. But there is a fear that we could be bringing harm to ourselves and to our family members.
So
it's very stressful right now.
I would imagine. So if someone passes away and they tested positive for COVID-19, that's not necessarily information that you're always going to get once they answer your care. We've heard a lot about the need for personal protective equipment in the past few weeks. I would imagine your staff also use this equipment, but there is a shortage in a lot of places. Have you had adequate access to it?
At the moment, we have adequate supply. I don't know how long that will last. Our suppliers, like everyone else's in the country, are having trouble meeting demand. The Indiana Funeral Directors Association sent out an email last night that said they have access to a supply of N95 masks that they will distribute out to area funeral homes. So I think everybody is working hand in hand to make sure that no one is left unprepared or unprotected. It's the best we can do right now.
Jennifer Nelson Williams is the president of ARN Funeral and Cremation Services. Jennifer, we'll talk with you a little bit in the next segment. Up next, we will also speak with a chaplain who specializes in grief counseling about the impact that social distancing can have on the grieving process. Today's conversation is pre-recorded, but as always, we are on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana if you have any questions or comments. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with Jennifer Nelson Williams, the president of ARN Funeral and Cremation Services. And Jennifer, I just had a few more things to ask. Regarding your staff, you're an essential service, and you've got a lot of people who have to be there for the type of work that you do. What's that been like?
Well, we had a talk at the very beginning, and I made it clear to everyone that there would potentially be a lot asked of us. We're so thankful to be in an industry that our jobs are secure, that we remember that daily. And we're trying to take the time that we need. So we have amended our hours slightly since we don't know when the need will increase dramatically. I spoke to one of my colleagues in New York this week, and they're working 12-hour shifts, and it's very frightening there. They're exhausted, they're overworked, and they have, the number of funerals that they have. The funeral home I spoke to, they normally do 25 funerals a month, and already, I think I talked to them on the 6th, they had done 75. So they are just seeing unprecedented demand, and they're exhausted. So keeping that in mind, although it may not be as severe here, I try and allow people to go home a little early in the days. And just we're trying to really stress our sense of family here, making sure we have the PPE that we need and the time for the rest that we need.
I'm really glad you brought up that example from New York, where the problem is particularly bad as far as being directly related to COVID-19 related deaths. I think it's important for people to know that that we don't want the same kind of a spike here in cases that could lead to, of course, more deaths. Have you been faced with other logistical challenges that you didn't anticipate?
Well, I mean, specifically this instance, the reason I spoke to a colleague in New York is because a person died here in Indianapolis, but their burial spot, their grave, was located in New York on Long Island. And typically when that happens, it's a fairly easy thing to accomplish. The airlines would take the person to the state where they have a burial plot. In this case, earlier in the day, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, I had gotten a notification from American Airlines that they were no longer taking COVID-positive people for shipment of human remains to another state. And so the last time something like that happened was after 9/11, when the airline shut down. So we had to have someone drive this person to New York. And because of the holiday, which Passover was beginning, we had one day to get her there. So it just added a level of stress for the family, for the funeral home in New York, and certainly for us, because we wanted to make sure that this family was able to have a committal service in a reasonable amount of time.
Well, Jennifer, I want to thank you for joining us today. It's a really hard time right now, and you're doing very important work, and it sounds like you're taking all the proper precautions. Jennifer Nelson-Williams is the president of ARN Funeral and Cremation Services. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you. I just want everyone to realize it's still very important to maintain these requirements of social distancing. We cannot stop now because the consequences could be very dire. Thank you for highlighting this. I very much appreciate your time.
We're talking today about how grief and loss may look different for families during the pandemic. We're joined now by Chaplain Paul Goodenough, who is part of the palliative care team at IU Health Methodist Hospital. Chaplain Goodenough, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
So can you talk a little about your position as a chaplain at Methodist Hospital? As a part of the palliative care team, what does your role typically look like?
So palliative care is the branch of medicine that focuses on quality of life and folks who are living with serious and life-limiting illnesses. So being a palliative care chaplain, many people associate it only with end of life. And so I try to take the opportunity to clarify that. And of course, nothing makes me happier than when patients get better and go home. But oftentimes, the patients who live are dealing with a brand new set of circumstances that perhaps hardship, suffering, pain, and discomfort that they may have to adjust to living with. So my job is really helping tap into spiritual resources, patients, families, and staff alike. Because again, I think I have to, you know, it's important to understand that a chaplain maybe sees a patient once, twice, three times, rare to have more than that. But I see nurses and staff all the time. And then every day. And then, you know, oftentimes patients can't talk. And so family members are just as important a part of the system. I'll leave it at that.
I wish that I could spend the whole hour with you and just ask questions about your job. I'm so curious about it. Everything about how you handle things. There can't be a magic, a magic wand part of your job. Everything has got to be different. But how has the pandemic changed how you do that?
It has fundamentally changed it. And even as I thought about talking to you today over the weekend, I still don't know if I have the right words for it. But I can just tell you it is so different. And I'm still struggling to find a new normal. for my job. And I'll just, you know, today I have been calling family members. And that's pretty much what I've been doing for the last couple weeks, with rare exception. Am I seeing patients in person? Even though not everyone in the hospital has COVID, of course, it's made work so complex. I mean, because of the extra communication, the extra layers, the extra preparation, and coordinating with other people, it has just made this job so hard. And, you know, last week on Friday, it hit me as I was getting ready to go into a patient's room. I was like, I haven't even been in to see a patient in a couple of days. And I was really sad. I mean, it was almost overwhelming. I almost had to take a minute because this is why I got into this line of work. I love to sit with people in their presence, make eye contact, and talk to them about how they're doing. And that part of the job has become very hard, very complex. It's mostly by phone and video now.
Is the ability, though, to use that technology, would you say that it's a saving grace, or is there very little that can substitute for that face-to-face in-person interaction that you're talking about?
Well, that's such a great phrase to use. Saving grace. It is. And
because it's as good as we can get right now, right?
That's right. There has been such extraordinary, but almost a universal gratitude on behalf of the families for whom we've been able to facilitate that. And as we've had patients who have both died and patients who've gotten better, but who've been awake and alert enough, to begin to talk with us. And just the extraordinary gratitude they have for that FaceTime, you know, even if it was just 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, there has just been an incredible, overwhelming gratitude. And that is the balm for those of us who are in the middle and trying to care for people and link them to their strength, to their family strength.
And we know that these isolation measures are necessary, of course, to protect patients and families and medical professionals alike. But even with that understanding, I mean, has it been difficult to make these changes?
Oh, yeah, every day. Struggling with it every day. Every day it's a fresh grief. You know, I don't like it, and I don't want to get used to it. I don't want it to become the norm in any way. I will take it as the meager thing that we have right now. But yes, it will be wonderful to breathe the same air, and to be able to hear stories again, uninterrupted, you know, by technology glitches. Mm.
Does the distancing protocol only apply to patients who have tested positive for COVID-19, or does it have to apply to other patients as well as a precautionary measure? I mean, it sounds like you're conducting all of your work from a distance.
Yeah. So essentially, so I'll speak to me personally and my own comfort level, which is it has made me think twice about all patients, not just in terms of course, not going into COVID patient rooms, because currently that's not something I'm doing, but it brings that extra layer of, like, when it used to just be common sense, I'd reach out and maybe ask a patient if I could hold their hand and just sit with them. That's not something that I'm doing right now. And I think that's, I would guess that that's a loss for all of us. Right. And I think to a degree, all of us who work here are experiencing that heightened anxiety right now. And of course, our patients must be experiencing it as well.
What's this been like for families that have to say goodbye to a loved one, but who can't be there with them the way they normally would have under normal circumstances?
You know, of course, you have to ask them.
Of course.
And from my perspective, it's heartbreaking. Again, this is what healthcare workers, and especially those of us in palliative care, got into this work to do, to give people comfort in the midst of suffering and dignity at the end of their life. And the fact that we are pretty much, as a rule, not being able to do that in the way that, that we've trained over and over again how to do, is just heartbreaking. It's hard, and it's overwhelmingly sad. We are working through our grief about it as a team.
What advice or comfort have you been offering to families who are finding themselves in this situation? Do you have anything new in your quiver that you're finding that you have to pull out a lot?
It's actually been overwhelming to see the gracious response of families and loved ones, friends, who need us, and we need them. You know, I was talking to a family member today, and we were talking and basically came to the conclusion together that we need each other more than ever right now. We always did, but now we know how much we truly need each other.
You work closely with medical professionals on the front lines of the pandemic, and I would imagine that grief isn't exclusive now to the families who have lost loved ones. Grief can emerge in different ways as well. How are they handling this?
We're finding new ways to adapt to the extreme grief. So last week we had a very sick patient, and it was a very long, intense process just to get the technology to work using different platforms, an iPad and an iPhone going into the room. And I'll spare you the details, but essentially we had a family that was talking and for the first time was able to see their loved one, to have a visual representation of what was going on. And it was so shocking to them to see their loved one. It was a powerful, and I can tell you, overwhelming. It was distressing to hear that family being shocked and to see them in that state. And, you know, that's something that chaplains see with some frequency, but there's other people right now who are being put into roles that they haven't spent a lot of time in. And for example, the nurses who are, or the patient liaisons, who are going in and taking this technology and enabling these face-to-face conversations, but then being exposed to just really intense grief. So, I mean, as a result of one of those, I had to just leave the unit and had to go find a quiet place to be by myself and grieve. And then I had went back up to the unit and talked to the nurse and told her I had been crying. And then she told me, yes, I cried too. And I said, well, maybe what we're going to figure out in the next couple days and weeks as this continues is we need to just make it normal to need to cry and to take moments when this was happening less frequently, it was easier to say, oh, I'll save it for the car ride home, or you know, I'll just kind of deal with it later. But no, I think we're in the midst of this crisis when we're faced with these overwhelming things. We have to pause together. We have to take moments to grieve together, not further isolate one another and say, oh no, you can't cry now, or you can't grieve this way, you can't do that. No, I think we have to grieve together. And I think that's what we're figuring out how to do, and take moments to grieve together.
But along those lines, do you have concerns about people who are going through the grieving process but are having to do it in more of an isolated setting than they otherwise would have? When you grieve, you need people, you need support, and that's not easy to come by now.
Yeah, I'll just put a plug out there for counseling in general. I'm a big believer in having not just people in your family and friend network who are people who know you and love you, but also have people, find people, and I'm lucky enough to work for an organization that has counseling services available to employees, at least in a limited basis. So yes, I think all of us need to engage all of our resources and not just rely on one person or ourselves, but be able to turn to other people, counselors, If you don't have that, you know, your faith community and mentors, people like that.
Paul, is there anything else that you want families who are working through grief to know right now?
Yes, we are all fumbling through this grief and this crisis together. We need each other. We are here for you. And I, as a chaplain, am telling my patients that I am here for you, but you are also there for your loved one. And there's a whole team here that is here for you and for your loved one. So we are in this together, and we're not perfect. Be gentle with yourself, and be good to one another. We will get through this.
We've been talking with Chaplain Paul Goodenough from the palliative care team at IU Health Methodist Hospital. Chaplain Goodenough, thank you so much for your time. We're wishing you the best in these coming weeks.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, listeners.
Up next, we'll talk with a grief counselor about why he believes we're not just experiencing a public health crisis right now, but also a pandemic of grief. Grief not exclusive to losing loved ones, but also jobs, support networks, and a sense of normalcy. We'll talk about ways to address and work through that when we come back. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on grief and loss in the midst of the pandemic. We're joined now by grief counselor Alan Wolfelt, who is the director of the Center for Loss Life Transition in Fort Collins, Colorado. Alan, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
More than happy to do so. Thank you for having me.
So we've been talking today about how the pandemic has shaped how many of us are experiencing loss right now. And you say that this moment has, in fact, given a rise to a grief pandemic. What do you mean by that?
Well, that everybody's been talking, of course, about the physical manifestations of the pandemic, but I've done some writing and reflecting on the fact that we're surrounded by grief in a variety of ways that relate to what we're experiencing. I often say that if you name something right now that you care about that gives your life meaning and purpose, it's in all likelihood that something is impacting you in a negative way, whether that's your distancing from family and friends to the very real reality of financial losses that people are experiencing, but most profoundly, it's the very real personal losses of family and friends that many people are encountering. But there's a variety of ways that I would reflect on how there's this ripple effect into our lives, ranging again from the very real reality of many people being impacted by the death of family members and friends, to social distancing, to personal events that have been canceled, to public activities, experiences that usually bring us together that we cannot do right now, to workplaces shutting down, people moving from work to their home environment, which is quite unique and different for many people. The list goes on and on in terms of the things that often infuse meaning and purpose in our life. And so we're faced with the need to take our grief, which is our internal thoughts and feelings, and openly acknowledge and do what we call mourning. Mourning is the shared response to loss. It's grief gone public. And that's challenged right now because people are more isolated. So many people are at risk for grieving how they're being impacted, but not mourning. Critically important distinction for people to aware of is how you integrate losses into your life is through active, authentic mourning. Not always easy to do in our culture, but something right now that we're just faced with the need to acknowledge that reality.
Well, I think a lot of us associate grief with death, but it sounds to me like the definition's a lot broader than that.
Very much so, Matt, that right now, you know, anything that you attach to that you experience the loss of, you know, we can think of a much broader framework of loss than just the death of somebody. That's the one that naturally people think of, and that's why many people have not recognized in part what it is they're experiencing is really grief. And the more you can name that and give emotions motion and acknowledge the reality of that, the better served you're going to be. I've created a framework where there's actually six needs we have right now as humans as we're faced with this pandemic of grief. And if you'd like, I can walk you down through those.
Yeah, I would love to. I've six needs. Here we go.
Sure. If you can identify those needs and actively work on them and kind of do what I call befriend them, it helps you integrate what you're experiencing into your life. And so among those are one, the need to one, acknowledge the reality of the pandemic as well as your grief. So first, ensure that you're accurately informed about the virus and measures that you could be taking and should be taking to keep yourself and others as safe as possible. There's a lot of misinformation out there, so go to factual sources and then acknowledge the reality of your grief about the pandemic. Secondly, honor all your feelings. It's common to experience a wide range of emotions with this grief we're facing, if you will, and those can range from disorientation to protest emotions to regret review to, of course, the hallmark of grief is feelings of sadness. But the more you can name your feelings and honor those feelings, the more you can integrate again the reality into your life. Thirdly, practice gratitude for the good that's in your life. To me, now is an essential time to be mindful of the good in your life, that sometimes we can get, you know, dark and light out of balance. And right now, of course, there's a lot of natural darkness, but we've got to remember that out of darkness comes light and to see what you have gratitude for and what's going to help you foster hope. So a fourth one I've written and talked about is, you know, the need to be self-compassionate or be kind to yourself. This grief needs and deserves our tender, our loving care, if you will. So make a good commitment to take care of yourself in five realms: physically, cognitively, emotionally, socially, and spiritually. A fifth need is to kind of search for meaning. Whenever we're faced with grief and loss, it kind of invites us into what I like to write about as liminal space, where you're betwixt and between. You're kind of suspended between a past for which you hope and hope to return into your life. But you're suspended, and so when you're suspended, you naturally go on a search. I always say those who do not search often do not find. So if you're asking yourself things like why questions, why now, why this way, don't shame yourself for that. Recognize that that's in fact what you're doing, is you've lost meaning in your life secondary to this, and now you're on a search. And then a sixth need is to reach out for support from others. You know, mourning by definition is the shared response to loss. It's grief gone public. So the challenge some people have right now in this isolation time in their lives is in fact being over exiled to the point that they're grieving, but they don't have that social context to mourn. So even during periods of isolation, we as human beings need personal contact. So encourage people to use this difficult time to talk openly and honestly with people you do have access to in your home, or to communicate with others through video calls or emails or texts or do something to keep you in touch with those outside yourself. So those essentially in my mind are six needs that if people are conscious of can help them kind of keep some balance at a time when our lives are out of balance right now, quite naturally.
We talk about the stages of grief as well, which a lot of people are familiar with the kind of grief that we're kind of all feeling right now in the midst of all of this, I guess we could say. Do those stages come in the same order, or is this different somehow?
No, while we owe a debt to Elizabeth Kubler Ross, who back in 1969 wrote that classic book on death and dying, a misconception of grief is it's orderly, predictable, and stage-like. It's anything but that. It's kind of like waves coming in off the ocean. Sometimes it's small and tolerable, and sometimes when you least suspect it, a huge wave comes along, maybe even a tsunami, and pulls you off your feet. So while it's in theory, a helpful concept to say, well, there's these dimensions, a term I much prefer to stages, because stages still denote order and prediction. Actually, before her death, she sat up and said, I wish I'd never used the word stages with these Americans. Because again, what happened is we became grief busters. We went around and started prescribing to people what it was they're going to experience. And she talked about, in theory, based on observing 198 people who were actively dying, the five stages of denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Well, there's much more to grief than that, but we, again, want to be reminded we owe her a debt, because she finally got North Americans who aren't real good at talking about loss and grief to talk about it. But I warn your audience of listeners out there, don't prescribe to others what they're experiencing. Use a teach-me philosophy and be familiar with a variety of ways that grief impacts us, and then be responsively supportive in response to people's needs. So if somebody's shocky or disoriented or protesty or regret review or sadness, whatever it may be, let them teach you. The true expert is the person walking through the experience. Hopefully that's helpful to folks. But you're right, there's a lot of people who are familiar with, quote, stages of grief. Think of dimensions as opposed to stages, and don't think of them as orderly, predictable, or stage-like.
Can you also explain what it means to experience anticipatory grief and how that might apply in our lives right now?
Well, sure. There's a lot of misunderstanding about the concept of anticipatory grief in that some people think, well, if I've anticipated the loss when I experience it, I'm done. But, you know, you're never really ready. That's intellectual preparation. But the context of what we're experiencing right now, you know, we're anticipating the potential of additional losses. Are we ever going to be able to return to work? Is someone in my life that I care about going to die? What about my own health? So anytime you anticipate potential grief and the need to mourn entering into your life, that's what formally gets called anticipatory grief.
And how, I guess, how much does the lack of a finite end date around the pandemic impact the way that we're able to process it? I mean, oftentimes one of the hallmarks of loss is that it is final. This situation is a lot more open-ended.
Well, it is, there's just a basic principle that you can deal with what you know and not what you don't know. So one of the challenges that many people face today is wondering when it will end. And a lot of North Americans have trouble with waiting, if you will. You know, we have trouble waiting for the light to turn green, for the elevator to arrive. And so now when you're in liminal space and you're having to wait, it creates a lot of personal angst for many people. So you have to kind of surrender to your reality or let go of control and be mindful about what you can do in a situation that you can't control. So as one European author said recently, as it relates to grief, the first thing you need to know about Americans is they think death is optional. Well, what's interesting right now is in a culture where we have pretty, what I call, low levels of awareness of our mortality or high levels of assumed invulnerability, people are now more confronted with the reality that we're all mortal and that we die. And when that happens, you have a choice. You can either acknowledge that reality, or you can try to go around it or deny it, which is some of the behaviors you see reflected by people who don't want to believe there's a need for social distancing, which is really, of course, physical distancing and various other things. And that, again, interestingly, as we observe that, has to do with, you know, kind of a sociocultural issue of, are we willing to befriend and confront our mortality, or do we like to deny it? You know, there's a time for denial, but this is not a time for denial. This is a time to acknowledge the fact that this virus is real and it's very easy to contract. And so you want to follow the guidelines that are out there that are being provided to take good care of yourself, not live in a state of denial.
What I'm hearing, though, and it was the second or third time you mentioned it, is that there are geographical differences in experiencing grief. I didn't realize that we as Americans, I guess, I don't want to say that we experience it poorly, but it sounds like we don't.
You can go ahead and say that.
Can I? I mean, it's yeah. Like, what is the difference between the way
if you study across cultures, North Americans are more likely to try to go around something than through it. And that's been influenced by a number of factors. We live in the world's first, for example, historically, what's called death-free generation, where many people now can live to 40 or 50, their parents are alive, maybe even their grandparents, so they come naked to the experience. We rapidly lost death symbols in our culture in the late 60s and 70s, where we started to move away from spending time with the body that had animated life, where we stopped sending flowers and as much food and various other things. We began to lose an understanding of the role of hurt and healing. The list goes on. When you see a convergence of those kinds of influences, you're set up where many people try to go around grief instead through it. But yet there's a basic principle that the only way the other side of something is, in fact, through it. So the more we can acknowledge that and befriend it and move toward those, for example, six needs of mourning, of acknowledging it, befriending it, still having gratitude, looking forward to the future, hope, and expectation of a good that is yet to be. All those things can help us survive this, because we will come out of darkness to light. But it's really tough for North Americans to do that, because we tend to try to live in a theme of don't worry, be happy. But right now, things are sad. I always say darkness is the chair upon which light sits. The more you can befriend the fact that we're in a period of darkness, the more we eventually will come to the light. But the more you try to be in light when you should be in dark, the more you fight against the realities that we're faced with. So yes, well, that was a long answer to your question, but I think there are cultural differences, and North Americans are notorious for trying to go around grief instead of through it. But right now they're faced with the very need to acknowledge their mortality, to take the precautions that are necessary, and do what we have to do to continue to have meaning and purpose in our life at the same time.
Regarding reaching out to others, you say that we were already in a loneliness epidemic before the coronavirus came along. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think there's an epidemic in North American culture of loneliness that while we don't want to overgeneralize that many people are over-isolated, particularly older adults in our society, where their cultures revere people as they grow older, where we tend to be a youth-oriented culture, and we separate out younger generations from older generations to some extent. And the consequence right now of if you already take a baseline loneliness that many people exist and now they're forced to further isolate, it just creates kind of an epidemic of kind of an existential loneliness or what is the meaning and the purpose of life and living. And so I can't encourage people enough to reach out to those who are isolated, particularly isolated seniors, who because of their higher risk right now, you've witnessed in the media people looking at them through windows, and I've had a number of calls to my center for loss with people who have parents in their life who have dementia who don't understand why they're not being visited right now and all sorts of things that relate to that sense of being alone and over-isolated. So staying in touch as much as possible, being consistent in that is something you can do for particularly isolated seniors. But we do have a loneliness epidemic related specifically to your question. And if you know somebody out there as a listener that's a particular risk for loneliness, please, I encourage you to reach out to them and let them know that you're there for them.
You say that grief is transformative, and we're certainly collectively experiencing so much loss right now. How do you think we might see transformation as individuals or even as a society from this pandemic?
Let me, if I could, remind your listeners there that transformation means, in fact, an entire change in form. So when I hear people saying, oh, we're going to go back to the old normal, no, we're transformed. We're changed. We can come to reconcile ourselves to the reality. Reconcile means to make your life good again. And I can believe and have hope that that will occur. But you're going to learn some things about yourself in this process. I've already spoken to a number of people who've come to realize now that they've gone into neutral, for example, that they've been work addicted and that they need to slow down and spend more time with their family, that at the end of the day, it's not about all the material stuff we accumulate. It's about the relationships with our family and our friends. So I hope we're going to emerge from this viral and grief pandemic a more conscious, a more cohesive, a more caring world. I think we have the opportunity to do that, but we have to have a consciousness about it, not trying to rush back to the old normal, but say, what did we learn from this? Growth means enforced life learning. So we don't want to, in a pejorative way, say, oh, we're going to grow from this. It's growth we would have assumed bypassed, right? But by God, growth will occur if you allow yourself to befriend it and say, what am I taking away from this experience? What changes do I need to make in my day-to-day living? And one of the biggest I'm finding many people are becoming aware of is that some of the things society teaches us are most important. What car you drive, what neighborhood you live in. At bottom, it's really your relationships, and it's anchored in love. And so I guess that's what I would say, reflecting on that.
We've been talking to Alan Wolfelt, the director of the Center for Loss and Transition. Alan, thank you so much for speaking with us today. We really appreciate it.
You're more than welcome. Being a former Hoosier myself, growing up in the big city of Lafayette, it's an honor when the media reaches out to have me comment. So thank you very much, and I wish my Hoosier friends well out there.
And we wish you well, too. Thank you. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Subscribe so you always know what we're talking about. Tomorrow, we'll spend the hour getting in the garden, talking about everything you need to know about native and invasive species in Indiana. In the meantime, we're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening today. This is All In.